You're listening to El Clásico, the cycling podcast at the 2023 Vuelta a España, from Barcelona to Madrid. Today we're on the Col du Tourmalet.
You are indeed listening to El Clásico. My name is Daniel Freiber and I am the host of this episode, and I am on the Col du Tourmalet, or in fact slightly down the mountain on the east side at La Mongie, on a day which for some veteran Grand Tour watchers may have brought back memories of the 1972 Tour de France, when Bernard Thévenet crashed on the descent of the Col de l'Aubisque and, badly concussed, assumed he was dreaming until, to his question, "Where am I?" his Peugeot directeur sportif Gaston Plot replied matter-of-factly, "In the Tour de France." Thévenet was relieved to have survived, and he later told the race doctor that he hadn't had to climb the Aubisque. Otherwise, he said, he would never have finished. Somewhat relevant, as I hinted, because another rider found himself suddenly dazed and confused on today's 13th stage of the Vuelta a España for entirely different reasons. And to reveal who that was and discuss the action today, joining me is Brian Nygaard. How are you doing?
I'm good. I had a small concussion myself yesterday. And you're a bit under the weather.
I'm under the weather today.
But someone had a worse day than we had. I think that's safe to say at this point.
Did you know that you were podcasting about the Vuelta a España yesterday, Brian?
Yes, I was aware of that. you put a coin in me, then I can talk about anything.
Or in similar fashion, did you go to dinner with your wife last night and say, "Well, bloody glad I didn't have to do the podcast tonight"?
Well, I am actually trying to go to dinner with my wife tonight, so we're moving in the right direction.
Very early, it's very early, Brian. I mean, Spain, this would be no problem. In France, it probably will be a problem for me, so I should kick on as well. The rider who was dazed, disoriented on the Col l'Aubisque early on today's stage, on the first major climb of the three monsters on today's queen stage of the Vuelta a España, was Remco Evenepoel. Of course, he went into today's stage as many people's favourite to win the race, didn't he, Brian? And, well, he lost a lot of time. He lost over 20 minutes, 27 minutes plus in the end, wasn't it? One of these sort of apocalyptic moments for the chances of a Grand Tour rider, which we see very often. Brian, when I was driving up here today on the La Mongie side, because that was the way we drove up, I was reminded of another one in 2004. Back in those days, the first big climb in the Tour de France often used to come after 10, 11 stages, and the suspense built and built over the first week into the second week. And I remember in 2004, there was a lot of expectation about all sorts of riders finally being able to challenge and dethrone Lance Armstrong. And whenever I drive up that road, it starts fairly gently, and before the road had even started climbing from Sainte-Marie-le-Compin that year, it was an absolute bloodbath as far as everyone's chances in the Tour de France were concerned. And this is something that happens often. That day, well, Ivan Basso, who you were working for CSC, he was sort of, well, the last man standing at the end of that first mountain stage, the only one who had any remote hope of challenging Lance Armstrong. And this always happens, doesn't it, in Grand Tours? They announce themselves as these fantastic cliffhangers, and then a day comes, a moment comes, when the cliff seems to fall into the sea, pretty much.
Yeah, it's just a question of how soft or how hard you land, because you will fall, apparently. I actually have to agree with you on this one. For once, this is the half empty type of glass we're staring at. You know, I'm not even looking for a coaster for that glass at this point, you know.
No. So I was at the top on the Col du Tourmalet, and you'll have experienced these moments, and we'll talk about it a lot later, when this does happen, particularly when it's a young rider around whom there's a lot of hype and a lot of expectation. And, well, there is almost a funereal mood always around the team vehicles, the team personnel. And, of course, I was up there waiting for Remco Evenepoel to finally come over the line with his teammates. And the rider, as always, he sort of comes back into the team vehicle area, the cordon, and no one really knows whether they're going to want to give an interview. Often the team press officer doesn't know whether the rider is going to want to speak to the press. And, well, sure enough, we talked We've talked on numerous occasions in this world about how much Remco enjoys communicating. However, he didn't want to communicate, which is perfectly understandable. So he sort of got his long sleeve jersey on and headed down the mountain. One rider who did talk at the top, Brian, and we're going to break with tradition, break with our normal pattern for these episodes. We're going to hear from a rider before the tail of the etapa, and we're going to hear from James Knox, our audio diarist, who was one of Remco's guard dogs today, and he accompanied Remco on, well, a bit of a funereal procession as far as his Grand Tour, sorry, his Vuelta hopes were concerned today. James, this afternoon when the stage started, was there any inkling that Remco wasn't feeling himself?
No, we were all for a normal GC day. Remco was feeling good before the start, and yeah, just wasn't his day. Clearly had a pretty rough day, so no, there was nothing that we saw coming.
In the race itself, at the moment when he drops, I guess, on the obisque, I mean, was that a key moment in the race where the pace sort of changed?
From what I saw, it felt like, because I was in the front just keeping an eye on Jumbo, they were riding a steady tempo, and they must have got word that Remco's in the back or something, because they accelerated, and then only like a minute later, I got something in the radio saying, like, yeah, Remco's having a bad day, so I dropped back, or the guys were already around him at that point, and the Jumbo train continued, so that's the last we saw of the front of the race, more or less.
I guess a bit of a strange experience the next 2 or 3 hours, and not much was said, I suppose. Tell me, what was it like riding alongside him over the next couple of climbs?
Silly to say, but for me, it's completely normal, isn't it? I've been dropped plenty of times, but I mean, it's hard for him. Huge weight of expectations on himself and from the media and everything, so I think he personally had a very tough time of it, you know, the weight of maybe feeling like he let himself down or other guys down and having to come to terms that his race was over here. But from my experience, you know, it's just part of bike racing that when you're not on your day, you get dropped and you crawl your way to line. It's hard, isn't it? I feel for him in his specific circumstances of the world looking on him, which is just no one else in the peloton has that. So yeah, anyway, it's bike racing, isn't it?
So, Brian, a lot for us to chew on there, and we will chew on it later in the episode, and particularly the issue of hype and pressure and expectation, which, as we know, was maybe more salient when it comes to Remco than with other riders. But, Brian, at this point, maybe we should hear who were the winners today. Well, there was one team in particular that was the emphatic winner of this Queen Stage of the Vuelta a España. So it's time for the tale of the etapa.
El resumen de la etapa. The tale of the etapa.
Thank you, Daniel. So stage 13 from Formigal to Col du Tourmalet, 134.7 kilometers. As expected, attacking from the start, but the first real significant drama went down on the climb to Col d'Aubisque, where at first he looked to be in trouble, but it didn't seem like Spanish TV had picked it up. But it didn't take long because the gap opened up and he cracked very early. Interesting small group actually with Caruso, Sepkus, Vingegaard and Landa. Landa and Vingegaard actually went off alone, but they got caught. There was UAE put in some work, and then it actually turned into a quite different stage than expected because Jumbo-Visma went into full control mode. The only real drama was about the KOM points, and Michael Storer took both of them, I can say at this point, at Col d'Espandel. And on the Obisque, Jumbo-Visma, they were in a great position. They had plenty of firepower left with four guys in the 16-man group in the lead with 13 kilometers to go up the Tourmalet. And then it was just this Lamy method, slicing off riders on the way up to the last climb. With 7 kilometers to go, Vingegaard attacked just at the point when Kelderman peeled off the front with his last turn. Kuss and Roglic were in control and the Dane went clear and letting everyone else work. And at this point, Marc Soler and Vlasov got dropped. Then Mas went, then Kuss followed. Then Roglic stayed with Ayuso and Uijsbroeks. And then Kuss attacked, dropping Mas. Vingegaard had around a minute with 2 kilometers to go, and then Uijsbroeks attacked. Ayuso was closing, and then it ended up with this big, massive Jumbo-Visma massacre because Vingegaard won, Kuss came in second, and then Roglic went. So Vingegaard won, Kuss was smiling in second, and Roglic roglified who whatever were left, and took third place on Tourmalet. So there you have it.
Let's run down the general classification, shall we? And talk about some of the other riders and who were sort of the dribs and drabs behind Jumbo-Visma. We've heard about Remco Evenepoel, obviously. Marc Soler was the closest man to Sepp Kuss, before today's stage. He defended himself pretty creditably. He came in 10th place, 3 minutes and 8 seconds behind Vingegaard. Juan Ayuso, he was the best of the rest on Jumbo-Visma's coattails. He was 4th at 38 seconds down. He also finished with, well, the unpronounceable, the undeniably talented Kian Uttebroeks, who incidentally we know has been suffering from a saddle sore. I spoke to someone from his team this evening and said, well, how did he do it? How did he ride so well today if he is suffering from that very painful and debilitating problem? And, well, it was put to me that probably 70 or 80 riders in this peloton have saddle sores of some description that they're suffering with. And Kian Uttebroeks is simply, well, he's never ridden a race this long before. So this is probably the first of many such painful experiences of that nature that he might have in his career. Still, brilliant ride by him to finish 5th, 38 seconds down. And Enric Mas was 40 seconds behind Vingegaard. And then came Landa, Vlasov, Steph Kras, and so on and so on. Another rider who started the day in very good shape and in the conversation for the general classification was João Almeida. And he did not have a good day. I think, Brian, he was suffering, he was struggling even earlier than Evenepoel,
yeah,
wasn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, he was. Apparently he's, unlike Evenepoel, he is actually ill.
Ah, okay. So he defended himself pretty well in the end. He finished 15th, 6 minutes and 47 seconds down on Jonas Vingegaard. Brian, we should also look at the GC now. Well, it's Jumbo-Visma 1-2-3. Sepkus leading. Primoz Roglic now 1 minute and 37 seconds down on Kuss. Third, Jonas Vingegaard, 1 minute and 44 seconds down. And we've then got a bit of a gap, almost a minute, to Juan Ayuso. 2 minutes, 37 seconds down. And Enric Mas is 3 minutes and 6 seconds down. I would say, Brian, that there is pretty much the threshold of what people, of riders who people would be still roughly, vaguely, tenuously in contention to win this Vuelta a España. Would you agree? I don't see anyone beyond there, even in our wildest dreams or expectations of what could happen over the next 10 days.
Not being fully familiar with what your wild dreams look like, Daniel, but I think I still think I have an idea. But I mean, even if you said, let's for the sake of argument, if the first three riders were from three different teams, there would be, you know, the gaps would somehow maybe be different. But now that it's three riders from the same team, those gaps are so solid. And when you look at the strength and numbers and everything, it's really hard to imagine that there's going to be a major shakeup still in this Vuelta.
Let's hear from some of the all-conquering Jumbo-Visma team, shall we? Let's hear first from the race leader, Sepp Kuss, who, as I said, finished second on the stage and is still, well, in a very commanding position at the top of the general classification. As I said, 1 minute and 37 seconds ahead of Primoz Roglic. We'll hear from him first. We'll hear from one of his key lieutenants, Wilco Kelderman, after that. No, in fact, Brian, we'll hear from Mark Reef, the Jumbo-Visma director sportif, about the team strategy today, whether they realised early on that Remco was maybe vulnerable. And then finally, we'll hear from Wilco Kelderman.
Yeah, I think that that first of all, Robert Geesink really deserves a big compliment. I think that what he showed today was incredible. He was really, really strong. He controlled it almost by himself. Yeah, and in the end, it was up to the rest to finish it off. We had the plan to do it like this. It was up to Jonas to start it, and then normally Sepp and Primoz only needed to follow. And then when they sensed the moment, then they would had the chance to go as well.
And just last thing, the Remco incident. Could you have imagined? And what do you think about that?
Oh yeah, I think it's shit for him. I mean, he also worked very hard to be on his top level here. I don't know what the situation is with him, but yeah, that's also sometimes cycling, and it's shit for him.
It was actually a really hard day. Was the whole day full gas, and yeah, we heard already in the beginning that Remco was dropping and Almeida, so we kept on pacing ourselves. On the Spandels was really hard, and then yeah, I need to do my job to get pace into the Tour my lab, but they did a really good job. Oh, it's crazy actually. how strong you are on the climbs.
Okay, what are these days like for you, having to think about, well, three leaders now?
I knew that Seppi was really strong, but he's doing three Grand Tours, and it's unbelievable what this guy is doing. Also, he's a super nice guy, so relaxed. For him, it's super nice. I hope he will stay there up front, and it looks really good for him.
Maybe next year everyone will be doing three Grand Tours. Maybe that's that'll be the new secret.
I don't think so. Seppi is really special. I never have seen a guy like this. For me, it's my second Grand Tour already in 3 months. Then that's already hard. But imagine if you do three.
Science in Sport is supporting the cycling podcast at the 2023 Vuelta a España. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Absolute jubilation in the Jumbo-Visma camp. We heard a bit of it there. We'll talk more about them later in the episode. We'll return, I think, now to the big loser of the day. The apocalypse that we talked about, this doomsday scenario that befell Soudal Quickstep today on La Mongie. I talked about that day in 2004, and you know, I was going to ask you actually, when you've been in teams occasions like this, because there is one in almost every Grand Tour for someone, occasions that you can remember that are burned into your memory of this nature. You know, talking about that day in 2004 at La Mongie, I actually remembered that particular day, a similar atmosphere around the T-Mobile vehicles, and it was Jan Ullrich who had failed to perform on that day, or failed to live up to expectations. And that day, it's a long time ago now, but I could almost detect on the part of the director sportif, particularly Walter Godefroot, the head director sportif of T-Mobile, a sense of disgust almost at Ulrich's performance. I mean, this was the latest in a long line of seasons, Tours de France, where Ulrich had failed to live up to expectations and his preparation had been questioned. And that was the case that day. And the difference that day was the crowds, the scrum of journalists around the T-Mobile bus was 10 deep. People had periscopes, people were climbing on chairs. It was bedlam up there. There was also a real contrast today with the last time I was at the Tourmalet, and the last time a big race climbed from that side, a big men's race, and the 2019 Tour de France. And that was a really heady atmosphere that day, because Thibaut Pinot won, Julien Alaphilippe was in the yellow jersey. I remember Macron was up there, and it was just a huge the mountain was throbbing with this French euphoria. And today, there weren't many people up there at all. The Vuelta, it doesn't feel to me, has had big licks in the French press, and that was reflected in the size of the crowd. But Brian, that was a very convoluted way of building up to asking you whether you remember, or you must have had experience of days like this for big GC riders.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the first situation that comes to mind, it was when Esteban Chavez was very close to winning the Giro, must have been 16. And he, I wouldn't say that Nibali came out of nowhere, but it what had looked like a very comfortable lead and a near certain victory just withered away. And yeah, it's like the sun stops shining, you know, at least for parts of the team. And I sort of feel like in those situations, I have a job to do, in the sense that I have to sort of facilitate, and I get rather busy, potentially even more busy than when you're winning. So it's not until afterwards that I sort of really get caught in the atmosphere. And once everyone gets to the hotel, and you know, everyone's trying to be sympathetic, and you know, I'd have to say that with Chavez at the time, you really need to take the lead from the rider, because he was quite good at pulling himself up, or at least sort of pretending to be quite sort of okay about the situation. And this is, I mean, you're not bereaved, you know, no one died, but this is what they live for. This is what they're trying to do. And some only get one chance at winning a GC. And that was probably the case with Chavez. So yeah, it's not a great situation, but for me, it has always been, I have to say, it's been work, and I had a job to do in those situations. It's the same thing that when you're reporting, you know, you can't, if you get caught up in the moment, we all have sympathies for certain riders, and some we maybe have a little bit less for, but it's work both for you and for me, and it certainly was for me in that situation.
It's interesting to hear James Knox talk there about the pressure, and it struck me, I mean, this is a pretty obvious point, that, you know, we often are preoccupied with the pressure when things are going well. You know, and we've talked a lot about pressure with regard to Remco. Since the start of his career, we've imagined the sort of spotlights on him in Belgium. We know what their press is like, and we know the intensity of their passion for cycling. You know, we see him, we talked about it in the first week, that he's the sort of duties, the protocol he has to do after stages, and that is when things are going well. And that's difficult, but it's nowhere near as difficult as I think, and I'm not suggesting for one second that Remco Evenepoel should feel any shame whatsoever, but I think it's programmed into our physiology, into our endocrine system as humans, to sort of internalize what we think are other people's expectations. And, you know, I just sort of put myself in his shoes, riding into that scrum of journalists and sort of feeling his face get a little bit hot and possibly feeling a little bit of shame that he has no reason to feel.
Yeah, it's a really awkward situation. You're absolutely right. Also, you can ask a million questions, but if you know, they also said earlier that, and James Knox said that as well, that he wasn't feeling unwell at the start. So there's an air of mystery to it, and also probably also if he's not able to point his finger, I mean, he felt probably absolutely horrible, worst days they've had in the bike, I would say. But then if there's no explanation, then standing there in that scrum, I understand why he would just go into the boss and say, look, I'm just going to have to talk to you tomorrow, you know, and in case he's still in the race tomorrow. And if he's not, he definitely, most of all, should talk to journalists. I mean, there's a lot of aspects to this that I find interesting. And what you said about the Belgian media, I mean, he's won the Vuelta before, right? He's shown his Grand Tour credentials maybe in a different competitive environment. But one thing that they'll need to confront and think about very carefully in his entourage and in his media people surrounding him, every single thing that the Belgian media wants to talk about now is not about the world. It's going to be like, well, how do you see yourself as a Tour de France contender in 2024? And that's the whole context of that conversation. And you do not want to have that conversation on top of the Tourmalet. But he will have to confront that, because that doubt now is there. I mean, he got COVID in the Giro, right? So this is the second Grand Tour that he exits with. I mean, I'm not saying that he's exiting, but that possibility is there. So people will start talking, well, can he be a real competitor up against Vingegaard in top shape or potentially Pogacar as well?
Brian, just as a curious aside, I looked up today how many days Remco Evenepoel has raced in France as a professional. Have a guess.
Less than five.
One. He had raced in France once, and that was in the Chrono des Nations, the end of season sort of time trial, which is almost a bit of a kind of exhibition race.
Yeah,
so he never really raced in France. I don't really think that necessarily reflects on his ability to one day win the Tour de France. But Brian, there is a bit of a question, and you know, we may find out, and he may find out a week from now, 2 weeks from now, that he was actually suffering with something. It wasn't affecting him badly, it wasn't affecting him every day. We may find that out, but I have found his performances quite curious in this Vuelta a España. I often talk on the podcast, I've in the past, about how hard it is to change momentum in Grand Tours, and when a trend is sort of sets in, that we usually see that trend perpetuated over sort of 3, 4, 5 days, which is not to say that it always happens, but it is a bit of a form sometimes in Grand Tours does feel like a bit of an oil tanker. Whereas Remco has seemed to, well, he's been riding this Vuelta a España on a bit of a jet ski. He's been sort of ups and downs. I can imagine Remco on a jet ski. He'd probably look very good
Sure he has one.
Yeah. But there have been these kind of, you know, not spectacular, but there have been quite a lot of sort of unpredictable.
Yeah, look at my predictions for today.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Also look at yours, but yours had like an editorial relevance, at least mine were just completely off.
You know, Hugh Carthy was in the hunt for at least 100 kilometers today.
Yeah, but then when you think of it, it's I actually thought that looking at the stages before the time trial and then the time trial, especially the Vingegaard, was definitely on the downward slope. But if you win, I would say even regardless with two teammates controlling everything behind and being absolutely safe, you're not on downward slope when you win on the Tourmalet. That's just not the case. And so there are definitely black swans, you know, unicorns, as you were, in the Grand Tour still.
just talking about highs and lows, I think you mentioned the sort of speculation there might be in the coming days about what went wrong today. There are a few amateur sleuths out there and some sleuths among the press pack here who have already donned their deer stalkers, and there are some who have already pointed the finger at the fact that Remco slept at 1,600 metres above sea level yesterday. But that, you know, possibly could have caused him issues. It shouldn't be, I suppose, ruled out. There are riders who struggle.
Sure. I mean, he's very familiar with sleeping in altitude, but training in altitude for Grand Tour is something completely different than recovering from, you know, the stage before and being ready for the day after. I just don't see that how that could explain or somehow give a reason to say that he lost all that time because he slept in 1600 meters. It's something that I would say that you would try to avoid if you could, absolutely. Mm. But I don't think that's not the entire story. I don't really, I'm not scientifically in a position where I can say that for sure, but I don't see that as the whole explanation.
Let's turn our attention to the front end of the race now and talk about Jumbo-Visma, this extraordinary performance. I said yesterday that Seb Kuss winning the Vuelta a España would almost be a consecration, a culmination for this project. The guy who, you know, he's only really in the team, in the squad as a super, super domestique. Him then going on to win a Grand Tour, it's almost the ultimate feather in the cap. However, I'd forgotten and overlooked the fact that, also on the table was the possibility of them finishing 1, 2, and 3 in this Vuelta a España, and that maybe some people would argue would have the same value, the same prestige, would be the ultimate sort of flag that they would plant on the mountain, on the hill, that might one day come to symbolise their domination. Where do we go from here? What is going to happen in this race now?
Can I just say two things to that? It is. And even winning with either of those three would be a culmination, but it actually goes a little bit against the team ethos if it's Kuss, because when you think of it, Pluger always says, Richard Pluger, the general manager of Jumbo-Visma, that their overall concept is dreaming with a deadline, right? So they'll have a dream to say, like, okay, well, this year, or it eventuated to be winning three Grand Tours in the same season. But it certainly was not dreaming with a deadline that it was supposed to be Seb Kuss, because A, he was not necessarily supposed to do the Vuelta. If it happens with Vingegaard, which you couldn't rule out at this point, he wasn't even supposed to do it either. So it's just a question of the level they have collectively, that potentially means that the guy who was supposed to win dreaming with that deadline would be Roglic. So I think that's quite interesting, that is, they're so good that they would even win with the third man, you'd say. But where do we go from here? In the words of the cave, and this thing is from one of his like older albums, where do we go from here but nowhere? It's like, how do you scrounge up excitement? I mean, there's some fantastic stages, but there's a part of the drama that somehow, unlike the Vuelta, it seems a bit deflated, doesn't it?
Yes, this isn't the first time I've referenced the hit TV or drama series Succession, but I'm sure there are some listeners who would like this Vuelta a España to start to resemble, you know, the fight to the death that played out in the Roy family in Succession. Will that come to pass? I don't detect, and, you know, being around the team this week and, you know, seeing them every day at the start, also knowing a little bit about the sort of relationships behind the scenes, for example, the fact that Jonas Vingegaard and Primoz Roglic share the same manager, they sort of confide in each other. I don't think that there's likely to be any interpersonal tension that might erupt in the last week. I'm sure a lot of people would like to see that. Which may leave us, Brian, in the invidious position that we often find ourselves at this time of year, every year, where all of our hopes of an exciting end of Vuelta rest with Enric Mas. That doesn't
bode well, I'm sorry. Well, all respect.
We shouldn't underestimate Enric Mas, because his record in the Vuelta a España is outstanding, and he's very, very consistent in a way that he's not in the Tour de France in the Vuelta a España. But, it just did occur to me today in what scenario might we see some real drama? It might be Enric Mas. Even today, had he gone behind Vingegaard and only Roglic was able to follow and Kuss was dropped, then, you know, that would have opened up a few different scenarios.
Yeah, but there is one thing, though, and maybe that's wishful thinking. If you look at the GC now, with the three Jumbo-Visma riders in the first three positions, Ayuso, Mas, and then Soler, you know, teammate of Ayuso, Landa further down, none of those riders are interested in a fourth place. They could not care less. Whether they be fourth or sixth or seventh, they do not care, and they shouldn't care. Uttebrook should care massively about trying to finish in the better part of the top 10, but none of those other guys, they have nothing to lose. So they'll need to do something spectacular. And the only thing that could change potentially is like who of the three Jumbo-Visma riders will try to follow and what will the outcome of that kind of attack be. But at least those are riders who can attack, and they have absolutely no business trying to defend the fourth place or riding to be fifth or sixth. That's our only hope then, right there. There it is.
I would have to agree with you, I think, Brian. Vingegaard, your countryman, if you had to rank them in order of likelihood, where would he be based on what you saw today?
He's as good as Roglic, potentially a little bit better, or maybe Roglic didn't have the best of days today. Today was also a little bit of a different type of stage than, I mean, you couldn't in any way compare this to Angliru, and you couldn't potentially even compare Angliru to any other climb in the Tour of Spain. So that's very different. And I think the possibility for them changing positions in the podium, Roglic and Vingegaard, most definitely. But I think at this point, also when what we saw today from Kuss, that they will try, and they're very different than before today. They are now in a position where they can actually help make Kuss win the bike race, because there aren't any other competitors who can take that away from him. So by any crisis or injury or crash or whatever, they can make him win if they want to. And I think they do. I honestly think they do. Or if they don't, someone will tell them that they have to.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Save big money on your outdoor project at Menards. Take the guesswork out of landscaping with our free, easy-to-use design program. Plus, Menards has the largest in-stock selection of concrete landscape blocks at the best prices. Get started on your dream landscape now. Visit us in-store or on Menards.com to see our full selection of landscape blocks and get your project started today.
Save big money at Menards.
¿Puedo pedir un pronóstico para la vuelta?
Hoy veremos a ver cómo sale esta crono. Quien salga vencedor de aquí pues tiene una ventaja y los demás tienen que ir a atacar. Y pues queda Pirineos, queda Tourmalet, queda Larrao. Los montañas de Pirineos son otro tipo de esfuerzo diferente a lo que ha habido hasta ahora.
Well, Brian, did you recognize that voice?
Yeah, but it also reminded me that...
Who was it, first of all? Tell the listeners who it was, first of all.
It was Miguel Indurain. Yeah, Big Mick. But he wasn't much of a talker either when he did win all of the Tour de France's he won. So unless you had actually paid attention and thinking about who that he might be, you know, by ruling out others, you wouldn't necessarily know it was Miguel Indurain. He wasn't much of a talker either, was he?
No, he was not. He was not, Brian. Incidentally, that was Miguel Indurain, as Brian said, talking to me a few days ago at the time trial in Valladolid about tomorrow's stage, and in particular about the Pont de l'Arro, which is one of the climbs on tomorrow's stage, rated by some as the hardest climb in the Pyrenees, or one of the hardest climbs in the Pyrenees. And, well, Indurain said it's hard, it's going to be very hot, probably. It's often very hot there. There's not much shelter. Very demanding, as is what has come before and what will come after in the Vuelta. You can definitely make the difference there. Brian, the Pont de l'Arro is a climb that Miguel Indurain knows very well. Before you tell us about tomorrow's stage, I'll just explain why he knows it very well. In 1996 Tour de France, of course, Indurain had cracked, really. He was going for a sixth victory, and he'd cracked in the Alps at Les Arcs. He was still on the edges of sort of contention to win the race in the Pyrenees. Of course, your countryman and old boss, Bjarne Riis, won at Ortakam. But the next day, it sort of been designed as a homecoming, a glorious homecoming for Indurain. It was a 260-kilometer stage from Argelès-Gazost to Pamplona, Indurain's home city, really. And, well, Indurain suffered like a dog, really, on that stage. He was 4 minutes behind the leaders as he came over the top of the Lahore. I've just got a quote here. Jean-Emmanuel Ducoin in L'Humanité said it was as though he was swallowed up by France, which wanted to keep him. Well, that turned out to be the last Tour de France that Miguel Indurain ever rode. And that day, Brian, has gone down as one of the most brutal Tour de France stages ever ridden. Chris Boardman finished 45 minutes down. He told me that it was the longest, hardest day he'd ever had on a bike. There was a huge group that came in 45 minutes down that day. And well, it's a beautiful spot as well. A really, really beautiful spot.
Do you remember that the awkward moment when Indurain actually went on the podium after the stage?
Yes.
I think the stage was won by Laurent Dufour.
It was.
And Riis consolidated the jersey, obviously. And then they brought up Indurain on the podium, which felt to me like so awkward, right? I mean, just, imagine that that the last mountains, like today, somehow detoured its way to Brussels, and then Remco had to be like dragged up on the podium. And it's not. Yeah, that was a bit weird, I found.
Yeah, it didn't quite go according to plan. That said, it is a really beautiful spot. You'll see it tomorrow. I think the whole stage tomorrow is going to be broadcast. So beautiful that Paddy Woodworth wrote in his The Basque Country, A Cultural History in 2007, "If the world ends as beautifully as this, there is little to fear from Armageddon." Brian, you're going to tell us about tomorrow's stage in more detail.
La etapa de mañana, la cena de ayer. Tomorrow's stage, yesterday's food.
Before we talk about tomorrow's stage, I will just fill you in on what I've been eating. Peruvian food last night, Brian, and very good it was too, in Huesca. We went to a Peruvian sort of fusion restaurant. There was a bit of Peruvian, a bit of sort of Asian in there. We had some tequeños, which are sort of little kind of parcels, ravioli type things to start with. And then I had some arroz chaufa. Chaufa rice is kind of, well, Peruvian, not quite paella. It's kind of, sort of a cross between paella and Chinese egg fried rice. But it was very delicious. And Brian, I should also say, before I forget, that the drive today, we came around the back way to the Tourmalet. So up the valley which leads to the tunnel's called the Bielsa Tunnel, and well, it was really breathtaking. We went over the Orquette d'Ancizan. We got held up by all sorts of different types of wildlife: donkeys, cows, bulls. I once wrote about a serial killer bear that had run amok on the Orquette d'Ancizan several summers ago and killed an inordinate number of sheep. Fortunately, no sightings of that. Well, in fact, that bear, I think, was run over by a car not long after his killing spree. But it was a really beautiful drive, Brian. Tomorrow, it will be a beautiful stage, but it's going to be a hard stage. Brian, tell us about it, please.
Yeah, it's definitely a hard stage. So tomorrow, stage 14, it takes us back to Spain, which I'm sure some will find. See, I was trying to play it down a little bit, but there you are. So it starts in Sauveterre-de-Béarn, and then it just moves slowly but firmly uphill to the first climb called the Rosaire. Long descent, bit of valley, and then we have the climb that you so brilliantly explained, the Puerto de la Rue, out of category climb. Descending into Spain, and then a bit of a valley drag, a small category 3 climb, all, and then you start the finishing climb up to Puerto de Belagua. I almost thought I said Beluga. I was like, I'm getting hungry, I suppose.
Oh, yeah. Sounds like a climb where you'd be among the favorites, yeah.
Thank you. But when you think of it, it's, on paper, this could be the most amazing stage, but there's a good potential that it would be a great stage, but I think there's a breakaway possibility that will actually come to the fore. I think tomorrow will be an obvious breakaway stage, given the situation we have in the GC now.
Yeah, and more breakaway opportunities may open up now, I would suggest, for good climbers who are stage hunters on this Vuelta a España. We thought that there would be a lot of that on this Vuelta. There have been a few stages like that. Indeed, Sepp Kuss owes his lead in the general classification to one of them when a big break went away. But we haven't seen quite as many as we thought there would be. I think that might begin now. Especially, I do expect Jumbo-Visma to face a bit of, criticism. There'll be grumbles. Certainly on social media, there'll be grumbles about their domination, their monopolisation of this race. I had a quick glance at social media in the hour or so after the stage today, and of course they're already indecorous comparisons with teams that who since have been kind of disgraced or their legacy has been tarnished. So there might be a bit of that. I never think that this really affects the way teams ride, and neither should it affect the way teams ride. So I don't know, Brian, you've probably been party to that as well in the past. With CSC there was a period when they were criticised for, you weren't the dominant team in the Tour de France, but you were quite dominant at other times of the year. And that was a different period in cycling when maybe there was some merit to some of the sort of grumbles.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the one thing that always puzzles me a little bit, you're a very popular team if you win, but there's sort of a line you cross if you win too much, and it just completely turns the opposite way around. And you just become extremely unpopular. At least in certain groups, even including groups in the media, as we saw, Vingegaard won his second Tour this year, and there was already complaining about him being, whichever kind of dodgy is the flavor of the month for certain journalists. But I have to say, though, with finishing 1-2-3 in the Grand Tour, and that's the outlook right now for Jumbo-Visma, that's going to be a massive thing for them, and it's like, riding cycling history. Will it win them more fans? Absolutely not. I remember once sending a really inappropriate text message to Brailsford the day when Froome crashed out of the Tour, saying that congratulations, this is the first step for becoming really
popular. Before or after you lost your job?
This was years after. But I said that this is going to make you a lot more popular, because sometimes you feel sympathy with when a great champion has to exit or finds himself in a really difficult situation unexpectedly.
I mean, come on, Brian. I mean, they've recast themselves as plucky losers having failed to win at the Tour of Britain today.
Okay, maybe that was maybe I didn't choose the right moment to say that. But it was all said in the context of winning, and winning a lot doesn't necessarily make you more popular. But I fully agree with you that should not change a millimeter of the strategy. They ride bikes to win, so that's not really their problem.
Brian, as you know, it's always a race against time to get dinner in France. We're about an hour away from Tarbes, where we're staying tonight, so I better head off. Not so many features tonight. We didn't go to the start this morning because it was logistically very challenging. Brian, that was surprising.
I think that's why you're under the weather, Daniel.
You know what? I love the start of a bike race. But we'll have Encuentro del Día, and we'll probably catch up with Larry tomorrow as well. And yes, Brian, thank you. You'll be back with us next week, I believe, on at least one day, maybe a couple. And in the meantime, good night, Brian.
Adios, Daniel.
And we did think that would be the end of tonight's episode. However, James Knox did want to add to his earlier reflections straight after the stage. So he sent us this once he was back at his team hotel in Lourdes. I'll be back tomorrow.
So I've been quiet for a few days. Not really had much to say, but on the massage table right now. Got the Rugby World Cup on. Big opener here, France, New Zealand. We're in Lourdes, first time here. Could see a little bit of the sights coming into town. Wasn't much to say from the rest day. I mean, of course, there was a few trials and tribulations of the rest day, getting there and the flights and stuff. But then the next couple of days were pretty straightforward. Did my best to save energy. And then, of course, all eyes were looking forward to today. It's our first big test. And, of course, it didn't go so well. But I think that's life, that's cycling. Major disappointments my end. I mean, of course, it will be a big disappointment for the team and for Remco, but best way to move forward is to just put it behind us, go for different things now, go for stage wins collectively as a team. We've still got a strong team that can get in the breaks on these harder days and do stuff, but I don't know. There's been no excuses or anything from Remco. I don't think it's necessary. I think it's just didn't have it on a very, very hard day in the Pyrenees, and you get found out pretty fast, don't you, when it's as hard as it was today. even for a rider of his capabilities. I mean, I think he's said it already at the finish line, but there's, you know, the world, the Belgian cycling media, the pressure he has on his shoulders, and, you know, his foot on the gas all year trying to win every single race. Maybe it was too much coming here, but anyway, that's just speculation and doesn't really matter. But silly thing about it all is he'll be more interested about Remco getting dropped today than the other standout performers of the day or whatever, you know. I feel like from my end I could just about murder someone in the UK and they'd care less, but, you know, Remco, he gets dropped for 10 minutes and it's 20 minutes even, and it's just absolute scandal, isn't it? And everyone wants to know, you know, national inquiry into what went on and if the, you know, if he's sick or whatever, but anyway. Other than that, I was quite all right. Stayed in the front, had to sort of cover Jumbo. So just marking them, but they weren't attacking. They were just riding tempo, which they continued to do all day, faster and faster by the looks of it. Can't say I had bad legs, but I'm sure, yeah, I would have paid for it down the line if I just stayed in. But anyway, yeah, it was actually a beautiful day in the Pyrenees, to be honest. I've never done Portalet, Obis, Spandels, or the Tourmalet from that side, so it was all new to me, and it was a beautiful parkour. Mum, Dad, and brother were on Spandels. We'll see if we can salvage something the coming days and last and the final week. So yeah.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Byrne.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Labor Day sale and get 35% off paints and stains August 22nd through September 4th. With prices starting at $31.84, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
This Labor Day at Lowe's, shop member-only doorbuster deals for a limited time. Save $50 on an Ego string trimmer, now $169. Plus, get 50% off select Holland pavers. Not a rewards member? Sign up for free today. But hurry, Labor Day doorbuster deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 9/1 while supplies last. Program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.